Thank you for listening to this teaching from Forerunner Fellowship. For more teachings or to subscribe to our podcast, as well as information about our congregation, visit our website at forerunnerfellowship.org.
And I'm going to actually, if we can entitle the message, see, I'll call this Acts 29, see, because, you know, the whole Acts 29 planting, church planting movement, yeah. So to tie it into the word a little bit before I jump in, I just want to give you guys just a little bit of the context, because I'm not going to give the whole intro to how I wound up in Africa. The gist of it was, I prayed about it for a long time, the Lord said go, and I went, and I took virtually nothing with me, and I didn't know anybody over there. And so when I landed, I didn't have anything, I didn't have any connections, I didn't know anybody on the continent, and did not know what I was going to do. And I was 22 years old, and filled with faith, and filled with boldness, and filled with passages like these that were backing me and fueling me to believe for the Acts 29 reality. You know, the reason we're doing this series on the book of Acts is actually that we would get the DNA planted in us more to believe God for Acts-type church reality now. And I've seen it. I've done it. I've experienced it firsthand in a very real way. And so I think it's fitting. If we're going to take a detour during this series on the book of Acts to tell about Acts in modern day and what some of those expressions look like through, you know, a source that you guys know. And I'm sorry, my personality is in all of these stories, so it's not going to sound like the Bible exactly, because you have to deal with the veil of me. But the realities of what was occurring was real. It was very much Acts-type leading, Acts type movements of the Spirit, Acts type authority and provision. And so I want to tell some of those stories tonight. And as I do, I just want to give you the ends of the Gospels of Matthew and the Gospel of Mark. And so Matthew 28:18, you guys, it's the Great Commission. It's one we know, but just think about what this means and how this applies. It says in Acts 28, verse 18, Jesus came to them, and he said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." So Jesus is, he's about to make a statement about what people are supposed to do, but he's going to base it on his own authority that he's been given. So he's about to give a commission that's based on his authority. He says, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you, and surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." And so here's Jesus saying, I want you to go and I want you to make disciples all over the planet. All over the planet in that context, when Jesus was saying that, they thought the world was a lot smaller than it turned out to be. But now, however long later, I'm actually on the other side of the globe in territory that they didn't know existed, going as a missionary, following this pattern of Matthew 28, the Great Commission, of going to the nations and preaching the gospel and making disciples, training them up, because I'll tell you what is far more powerful than someone who has been evangelized is someone who's been discipled. Infinitely different. So making disciples of all nations, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you, and surely I'm with you always. So that's one passage that was very much in my thinking, my commissioning, what it was I was carrying in my heart as I felt like the Lord was sending me over to Africa. I'm carrying the Great Commission. Secondly, I'm carrying Mark 16:15 through 18. And I was in a church context that if you guys have study Bibles, a lot of times your study Bible will make a statement in the study Bible that says the later part or the latter part of Mark 16, doesn't include this passage in the early manuscripts. And so I was in a denominational reality that would teach that these verses were actually mute, that these verses, they didn't apply, that it was a question of whether they were canonical or not, and that that the teaching about these things was not for, you know, us to apply and for us to bring forward. And I remember going to some guys and talking about this, and they're like, well, that's not actually, we're not really sure if that should really even be in the Bible or not. I was like, how did it get in there then? Oh my gosh. Anyway, Mark 16, 15 through 18. Go into all the world and preach the good news. Again, all the world. Preach the good news to all creation. Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned. And these signs will accompany them. And I just want to stop there for a second. Signs. That's what I was after. Not only these signs that they list, because I think that Jesus meant far more than just these, because we see the book of Acts had a whole lot more signs than just these signs. But the point was, the messenger appointed by the Lord and sent into the nations to do the work of the missionary, to go and do that work, signs will accompany them for them to go and do the work of the ministry, and so that they don't die, so that they can keep preaching the gospel. It says, whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but these signs will accompany those who believe. In my name, they will drive out demons. They will speak in new tongues. They will pick up snakes with their hands, and they will drink deadly poison, and it will not hurt them at all. And they will place their hands on sick people, and they will get well. When I felt like the Lord told me to go to Africa, I was carrying verses like these and a number of others strong in my spirit that this is what the Lord was going to do. He was commissioning me, and he was therefore going to use me powerfully. And I didn't know what stories I was going to have, but I went with full assurance I was going to get stories, or I was going to die really early and graduate early and not have to deal with all this mess you fine folks have to deal with down here. And so I was convinced that the Lord was the God of the Bible, and that if he was commissioning me, I was going to see him move in powerful ways on my behalf. And so I was carrying this when I landed. Now, again, for those of you who have heard me tell the stories, you know that it wasn't long after I landed that I more or less got kidnapped by a crime lord and wound up living with a crime lord for a period of time. And that was really interesting. But I'm going to skip that foundational part of the story for those of, because a lot of you already in the room already know that. And just ask me some other time or ask somebody else who knows. I'm now going to just tell you about some of the things that started to happen as I'm now living in this crime lord's house and I'm starting to minister. So the first thing I want to tell you is that probably had the Lord not orchestrated all that in just that way, he would have had to have worked a whole lot harder to do miracles for me to be useful, because that crime lord's household all spoke at least a little bit of broken English, and almost no one else in the entire country spoke English. I mean, with very few exceptions, not none, but way less than 1% of the population, way less than 1 out of 100 people spoke English, way less. So to find people to be able to minister to, and I only knew English and Pig Latin, it's difficult to try to rally a group of people to preach to. And so the fact that the Lord planted me in this crime syndicate where all of them knew some English a little bit because it was their job to coerce white men, tourists, and that kind of thing so that they could get their money or kill them or whatever they were going to do with them, they all knew a little bit of English. So I'm living with this crime lord, and I've got favor with him, which is just wild, but you know, you can see in the scripture occasions where a wicked leader, a wicked ruler, would for some reason that you just, if you don't just really pay attention to the details, you kind of glance over the fact that it seemed like Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel were buddies. And Nebuchadnezzar was an idol-worshipping, demon-worshipping, murderous, cutthroat king. And Daniel was a man of God. It's like, how did those two sit at the table together a lot, you know? There was just a favor. Well, I got favor somehow. The Lord had me just curry favor with this evil crime lord guy, okay? So I start doing what it is I came to do, and that was witnessing to whoever I could witness to and talking to him about Jesus. And the guys I could witness to were his henchmen. And so I've now got the favor of kind of the papa of the house. I've got his favor to be in their house and to be a Christian. I mean, he hasn't told me I can't preach, and if he had, I would have done it anyway. But I mean, he hasn't told me that. So I start preaching. And it's not long before I'm in daily, like, discipleship slash please come to Jesus meetings with about three other guys, Mustafa, Hum Hum, and Pichu. Those are the three guys that I specifically was just, you know, really, you know, laboring for in that household. And Hum Hum was the crime lord's number two. The crime lord's name was Kardair, so I'll just refer to him as that from now on. So Kardares number two was this guy named Humham. Humham's real name was too hard to pronounce. His native language was Wolof. And if you ever hear anybody speaking Wolof, it sounds like Humham. So I just started calling him Humham because every time he'd talk in Wolof, it just sounded like Humham. So he was fine with that. He thought it was funny. And so I called him Humham. He called me my guys. I guess he saw some movie somewhere, was like, come on, guys. Let's go, guys. And he caught that and turned it up a little bit and flipped it around and called me my guys. So I was my guys. He was Humham. Enough said. So I'm talking to Humham every day about how he needs Jesus. And I'm teaching him a little bit of English. His English isn't awesome, but he knows a lot of languages. He knew like 6 or 7 languages already. So getting him caught up to speed on English was like the easiest thing ever. I mean, I looked like a brilliant English teacher, which I've all but failed English, I'm sure, all throughout high school. But it's just because he was so brilliant, his mind was just very adapting to language. So I'm talking to him and I'm working with him and I'm telling him about Jesus and he's kind of asking questions and he's a Muslim and I'm in a country, by the way, that's 99.9% Muslim. So the other 0.01% makes up every other religion, including the animists that are still in the area. I mean, so it's like there's very few Christians in the area. Very few. I'll touch on that here in a little bit. But I can remember one day, it was maybe 2 weeks in, and I've been talking with Humham every day. And I've got him, and we're off somewhere running an errand for Kardare and one that was not so nefarious, just so you know. And I think it was getting a camera fixed or something. And I'm talking with Humham, and we're doing something. We're talking to this guy, and the guy goes back in the back of the shop, and we're out in this courtyard area. We're under this palm tree, and I can just remember it so clear. Humham looks over at me, and he goes, my guys, and he smiles at me real big. I go, yeah? He goes, I has to Jesus now. And I go, Humham, are you telling me you like gave your life to Jesus? You like got saved? Yes, my guys. That's what I'm saying. So warm. And I just was like, oh my gosh, this is great. And then I start processing because 2 weeks in, I really knew this guy was a bad guy, Kardare. I didn't know entirely all the details, but now I'm like, I've seen enough. I know enough. This dude is a bad dude. And this is his number one henchman that just got saved. And I'm like, oh, man. And my mind starts turning. I go, we better figure out our exit strategy. And I'm taking Humham with me because I am not going to leave him to the wolves. I'm processing all this as he's telling me. I'm so excited about what's happened. And I'm so freaked out for Humham. And I'm also freaked out for me because now Humham and some of the other guys, they start to not want to do the bad stuff anymore, as you can imagine. And they're getting a little counsel from someone that they should not do such bad things and that they should follow, you know, the Lord and that kind of thing. And the Holy Spirit's moving on. It's a powerful time. And so anyway, I can remember. I'll just skip forward one more time with Humham, and then I'll tell you some Humham and Brad stories. So it's now maybe, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks later. And things are starting to get intense back home, and my welcome is running short, and his fuse is wearing out. Kardare's fuse with this white guy that he let live with him, and so Humham one day, it's another one of those little kind of sacred moments kind of deal. At this point, I've gotten him a Bible in his language. I've met a church in the area through a crazy story I won't tell, and it was just wild. And so they got me a Bible in French. He knew French. I didn't know French, but I had my Bible in English. He had his in French. And now we'd start to, like, I'd point a verse in mine, and he'd open his and that kind of thing. So he's reading it kind of like vigorously. Now, I haven't told him anything except he needs Jesus, read the Bible, follow the Holy Spirit, do good, don't do bad. You know, I mean, just basic stuff. And one day he looks over at me and he goes, hey, I is Timothy. And I go, huh? He go, you is Paul. I is Timothy. And I go, oh my gosh. You get the discipleship relationship? Like, you get that I'm a missionary from America that came all the way over to Nowheresville and found little old you and brought you to Jesus, and I'm your spiritual father? I'm like, oh my gosh. And he goes, yes. He says, now let's do his work. And I'm like, this is awesome. And so Hum Hum and I were connected at the hip at this point. And now everywhere I went, he came with me. Everywhere. I mean, we'd go, I'd go here, he'd come with me. I'd go talk to this person, he'd come with me. I'd go to this preaching engagement, whatever. All this stuff, he's coming with me. So what's great is, I've told you guys this a little bit before, for those of you who've been around, but we're now going out every day evangelizing. And I'm evangelizing in English to whoever it is I can find, and I'm pointing to certain Bible verses, and now Hum Hum is going to those same Bible verses in his Bible, and now he's translating them into the dialect of the people, because the Bible's in French, but the people speak Bambara, which is the native language, and so he's got to translate it, and he did it seamlessly. It was like, well, sure. It was like tie your shoe. It was so easy for this guy. He made the perfect Timothy. It was unbelievable. So we're now going around and we're evangelizing to people all the time. I mean, every day we're spending a lot of time out in the streets. We're just talking to people. We're making appointments with people. And at night, so during the day we're doing these. And then at nights we're doing outreaches because we've connected with this church. They have a sound system and we're able to do outdoor preaching crusades. I mean, near nightly for a few weeks. And so we would just go to this part of town, do a preacher crusade, this part of town, do it. And we got the speakers. And just because I was a white guy in an area that had never seen a white person ever in their life except on television, they would come to hear me speak because I just wanted to hear what the white guy, it was like a muse, you know, it's like, who and what is this? And so I could preach and then I'd have Hum Hum or somebody else translate from the church. And so anyway, so Hum Hum and I are going out every day and we're ministering and we'll find somebody, and I start, you know, I'm going through the same Bible verses over and over. I'm just trying to keep it simple. You know, I'm like, man, let's just keep a simple gospel. Let's just keep doing the same thing over and over again, and I'll just kind of learn as we go here. And so Hum Hum's going out with me every day, and he is now, after, you know, a few days, maybe a week or so, he's got these Bible verses down. He knows where they are. I'll open and I'll start to tell him. And he goes, no, guys, I got this. I got this. He's like, I know where you're going. I know what the next verse is. I know what you're going to say next. And he'd start saying it. Sometimes I'd find him and we're in the middle of this dialogue and it's me and the person I'm witnessing to. And then I'd hand it off to Hum Hum to translate. And then I'd find a few times Hum Hum's just hijacking the conversation. And he's just witnessing and ministering. So I remember one day he comes up to me and he goes, my guys, I go into the town, I talk to this guy, and we talk about Bibles, and he says he wants the Jesus. And I go, well, did you lead him to the Lord? He goes, no, I don't know how to. I go, you can do this too. You've been doing it. He goes, no, you do that. I go, you can do that. And I go, well, where did you just leave him? He goes, my guys, it's me. I got this. And I go, what he goes? He goes, tonight, the 7, we meet. And I was like, you booked another appointment so I can go in and just like, the fish are jumping into the boat because you already evangelized to the guy and he wants the Jesus? I'm like, this is going to be too easy. So we go and this guy gives his life to the Lord. It's just like cool stuff like this. We're just seeing it. And again, daily, I'm still now having discipleship conversations with these three guys, Pichu, Mustafa, and Hum Hum. And I'm just giving them the word and training them up. And they're at this point, they've given their lives to the Lord and they're starting to walk with the Lord a little bit. And I've given them all Bibles and they're all living in this crime lord's house still. They're still living under his rule. And Mustafa was one of his henchmen. And Pichu was kind of like a live-in servant kind of a guy. I didn't exactly know what his role was. But these three guys, every day, I'm like meeting with them at a discipleship level. Hum Hum and I are going out every day. And we're evangelizing one-on-one. And then many nights, we're doing gospel preaching crusades. And then in addition to this, a couple of cool things started to happen. One of the things that I just was like, Lord, how did you do this? This was just so like apostolic. Like, how did you set this up? Was there, I told you about the percentage of the church, 99.9, you know, Muslim. Well, that other 0.01, it's not all Christian. There were only about 15 churches, from my understanding, in the city of 3 million people. And all of those 15 churches were pretty small, with the exception of one or two that were a little larger. There might have been a few more, but that was my understanding from the context of what I was given, at least of the Spirit-filled side. I think there were a few more, maybe another four or five, of some larger denominational churches But a lot of those, at the admittance of some of the other churches, a lot of them were kind of watering things down so that they would not stir up any trouble in the city that's 99.9% Muslim. So, got me? All right, so anyway, my point is there's not a lot of churches there. Well, one of them happens to be two blocks from this crime lord's house, and that's how I run into the pastor, just crazy. He's got this church. It's like 2-3 blocks away from the crime lord's house. I connect with him. He's the one that helps me start doing the outdoor preaching crusades. Well, here's the crazy thing. I'm now witnessing one-on-one every day, and we're doing these outdoor preaching crusades. Some of the pastors in the area are now coming and asking me, who has all of 2 weeks' experience ministering to Muslims, to come teach their congregations how to minister to Muslims. So I'm now going, I can remember two different occasions, going to different churches and teaching some of their leaders how to do evangelism, how to evangelize Muslims and like what to say. And because we're seeing a measure of success, not a lot, but we're seeing some people come to know the Lord and they weren't really used to that. And so they're like asking me to like, you know, teach them how to do that. I can just remember the first time I'm in this church and I'm like, I cannot believe this is happening right now. I'm in a church in Africa teaching African believers how to minister to their own culture. Like, how in the world is this? It's impossible. But that's what we see in Acts. We see these favor situations. We see these opportunities. We see there, of course, the religious leaders were so jealous of Paul and Silas or Paul and Barnabas because there was favor on these guys and they were able to do stuff that nobody else was able to do. I saw that. I had that favor, and I was walking in it, and it was crazy. It was crazy to see it and experience it. Small churches, small, you know, things, but the opportunities happened. One more happened in this. I had been in the city for less than 2 weeks, so in Africa for less than 2 weeks. And remember, when I went, I had no plan, no money, no backup. I didn't know any contacts. I didn't know what I was going to do. I had nothing except the call of God, like when we see the Lord speaking, you know, to Paul and saying, you know, in a vision, the man from Macedonia saying, come over here. Paul has no plan when he gets to Macedonia. None. But he's going to go, and the Spirit of the Lord's going to tell him what to do next. Well, I had that in my backlog. I'd read the book of Acts a bunch, fueling myself on it. So it's like, I just went believing if I just go to Macedonia, because he told me to, he'll show me what to do when I get there, and he'll make doors open. I'm there for less than 2 weeks, and I have an opportunity to preach on the radio. As a city of 3 million people, they've only got about maybe a dozen, maybe less, probably more like 8 or 9 radio stations in the whole city. And one of those stations was an all English speaking station. And a lot of people, when I say a lot, I don't mean like 50% of the population. It was probably like 3% or 2% of the population would listen to that radio station to try to learn English. Well, so the English station, they did most everything in English, except they'd make some little announcements and stuff in the native language. And so they gave me an opportunity, and it was just kind of like, hey, you're an American, you know, from America, say some America stuff. And so I got to preach on this radio station to whoever was listening. I don't know how many. I don't know what seeds I planted. I have no idea. I got to preach on this radio station in the capital city of Mali in English, and we didn't have an interpreter. I don't know what happened. I picked up that microphone, and it was another one of those, I cannot believe this is happening. Like, I wouldn't have even known to put this on my bucket list. Like, this is so wild. Who even thinks of this? I'm getting to preach, and like, it was just crazy. One of the things that just was a mile marker to me, it wasn't so much of a miracle, but it was so marking in my life. The Lord had me come at just the perfect time. The pastor that I just miraculously ran into that lives two blocks away from the crime lord's house, the pastor for years had been working on trying to rally a network of churches in the city. And the problem that they faced with such persecution, so few believers, was it was constantly division in the church, not in a single congregation, but in the church of the region. There was constantly fighting and quarreling amongst and sheep stealing. I mean, even like bribing, like, hey, I'll let you become a deacon over at our church if you leave that church and come over here. Crazy stuff. This pastor just kept, he just had a heart of gold and just had a real, you know, tender, just apostolic, you know, calling to call people together and to bring the church together. He'd been working for a decade to bring these churches together. And it just so happened that the first time they were ever coming together, 13 of the churches. So again, it was all the ones that they knew about, less five of some of the denominational churches. And I really think that that's about all that were there. And when I say a big denominational church, I mean 150, 200 people. Most of these churches were 20, 30, 50 people. That was a big church. 50 would have been a good sized church. So see, don't feel so small. So where I come from, this is a big church. So this pastor had been laboring for this. They were having their first meeting. I got to go to it. The first time the church in Bamako had come together in as long as anyone could remember. Nobody had documentation of the last time anything like this had happened. It's not to say that it never had. They just, nobody alive knew about it. And I got to see these 13 pastors up on a stage, hold hands. There were enough people that came that they rented out a downtown like convention center kind of a thing. And there were believers of all these different churches, 13 different churches there, praising Jesus. And I got to be there. And it happened like 3 weeks after I landed. I got to be there for the first time these churches came together and that they just supported one another. They made a covenant together that they were going to support one another. They weren't going to fight. They weren't going to steal each other's sheep. They were going to pray for one another. They were going to bless one another. It was monumental. It was like so powerful. This pastor had been fighting for this for years and years and years. And boom, it happened, and I got to experience it. It was crazy just to see the Lord do that in that time period. Well, I want to tell you guys a couple of cool stories, a couple of, you know, signs and wonder stories or power stories, whatever you want to call it. So we're doing these preaching crusades, and every night when we preach, I'd tell people, because again, I'm believing the, you know, Mark 16, these signs will accompany. You'll lay your hands on the sick and they'll be healed. I mean, there'll be tongues. I mean, we're going to see the move of God. And so I'm believing that. And I'm preaching it. And I'm preaching it. And even the pastor that I'm with, like he like theologically believes it, but experientially he hasn't seen much of it. And so it's kind of like, okay, I hope you're really the man of God you say you are. And I'm like, I'm not saying, I just came over here. I don't know what I'm doing. I just believe in God. Like, I'm the believe God guy. I'm all that. I mean, I am super weak enough to believe God for everything, you know? And so so I'd preach, and I the translator, a couple times, it was one of the guys that was part of the church, and I'd say stuff, and he'd look at me like, you really want me to say that? And I'd be like, say it. And then he'd say it, and I started to learn how he was dumbing it down a couple of times because I'd learn a few words. I go, no, not that word, this word. And he'd go, okay. And he'd say that word. It was so fun. And so, one more thing. And almost every night when I'm preaching, I am this close. I don't know what it was about the nursing mothers front row every time. And they don't cover up. And so I've like got four nursing mothers. I'm serious, like 4 feet from me. I'm 22 and I'm like, I'm looking up as I'm preaching. I'm like, try to make eye contact. Don't go any lower. You know, it's like, oh my gosh. And they would cover up the other side either. I mean, they're just like, I was just like, okay, you're naked. I'm preaching, you're naked. Normal, very normal, normal. And so anyway, we do these crusades, whatever, and I'd be preaching. And I'd say, listen, the God who wants to heal, to save you also wants to heal you. And I believe that the Lord will release healing tonight in order to be able to provoke your faith to believe that Jesus is really God and that Muhammad is a liar. And I'd say that, and a little side note, there were a number of times where Hum and some of the other guys from the church, they'd say, if you keep preaching like this, they will kill you. I go, that's okay, I'm not going to die. They go, no, you will die. And go, I go, no. They go, you do not know Muslim man. And I go, I go, well, you're right, but I know the God that commissioned me over here, and really, death's not so bad. I'll teach you about that tomorrow in discipleship. I'll tell you about that one. You know, heaven's a good thing. It's okay. And they're like, they will kill you. And I was like, they're not going to kill me. And even if they do, it's fine. So I'm preaching, you know, to tell them, you know, that Jesus want to heal you. Okay. So one night, and we got to lay hands on a bunch of people, and we saw a couple of minor miracles, headaches and little things. I didn't get to see any limbs grow out or anything. I really wanted to. And prayed for a few people and prayed for some blind eyes. Didn't get to see blind eyes open. But I was praying one night after the crusade, Hum Hum comes up to me and he goes, my guys, the son of the Marabou, he want to talk to you. I go, really? Well, that's the local witch doctor, the Marabou. And I'm like, the witch doctor's son wants to talk to the preacher. This is awesome. And so I go, okay, where is he? Where he goes? He goes, no, he's so scared. He's so scared. He goes, he says, not now. If he's dead, find out. He'd kill him. And so I go, okay. I go, well, he goes, my guys, it's me. I make appointments. It's tomorrow. It's such a time. I go, okay. So we meet, and here's this witch doctor's son. And he goes, I heard what you were saying, you know, about Jesus, and I want him to heal me. And I go, okay. I go, well, I believe he will. And again, all through Hum Hum interpreting. And I tell him, I go, okay, well, I'm going to pray for you. I said, but listen, I'm telling you right now that Jesus is going to heal you as a testimony that Jesus is the Son of God and that you need to give your life to him because Jesus is God and you're following false gods that are not real, that are leading you astray. Jesus is God. He goes, okay. And I said, so if he heals you, what's the message? He said that Jesus is God. I go, okay, all right then. So I pray for him, and I pray for him, and he just, I pray, and he gets done, and I go, okay, you good? He's like, yep, and he just walks off and leaves. I was like, okay, well, I mean, I wanted to talk a little more. I mean, I could pray for you again. If it didn't work, I could do it again. I could pray three times even. And so he leaves. So it's a couple of days. And Hum Hum comes up to me one day. It's 3 days later or something like that. He goes, my guys. He says, I sees the Marabou son. I sees him at the market. I go, oh, really? Okay, cool. We went wondering how he's been doing or whatever. He goes, he's healed. And I go, oh, I forgot to tell you what was wrong with him. Okay, so from birth, which, I mean, he's born into witchcraft. Of course he's born with a curse. Of course, okay? From birth, he's had constant back pain, and he's a little bit hunched. Not super hunchback, like you may not even notice, but I mean, anyway. A little bit hunchback, but pain, searing pain in his back all the days of his life. He said he had never known a day ever without pain. He goes, so Hum Hum goes, I see him, he's healed. And I go, really? He goes, yes. He says, when the white man lay hands on me, I feel fire. I feel fire in my back. And from then, no pain. No pain. None. Not one time. No pain. Days. It never happened before. And I go, where is he? He goes, my guys, I got this. We meet him tonight. We talk. I was like, Hum Hum was the man at the follow-up. I'm just telling you, he did. I mean, I was always like used to teenagers who dropped the ball. You know what I mean? It's like, because I was doing youth ministry before I went over to Africa, but dude, Hum Hum was on the ball. Okay? And he had this awesome lazy eye, so you never knew if he was looking at you or not. It was awesome. And then I showed him I had one, so he like felt kindred or whatever. So it's fun. So anyway, I do, actually, if you don't know that about me, I can show you later. It'll freak you out. And I have control over it now because Pancake's mom did eye therapy with me when I was like 7 or 8. So there you go. And then Pancake and I meet 15 years later and find out that his mom was my doctor when I was 7. It was really a cool story. So now you know I have a lazy eye that I sort of have control over sometimes, except when I'm really tired. So Hum Hum, Hum Hum has set this appointment up, okay? And so I'm going to meet with him, all right? And so we got this, and we meet, and I'm just like, tell me the story. So he more or less says, yeah, you know, when you laid hands on me, when you put your hand on me, I felt fire come out of your hand and run down my back and, like, rest on that area and, like, or something, and, like, healed it and no pain. And he said, I left, and I didn't know what just happened. Like, But then the next day when I woke up and there was still no pain, and the next day, he goes, I'm healed. I'm completely healed. I go, okay. I go, well, then what does that mean? He said, that means that Jesus is God. I go, okay, are you ready to give your life to Jesus? He says, no. I said, what? He said, my father will kill me. I go, well, I don't know that Jesus isn't about to kill you, son. I mean, my goodness, he just showed you that he is the Son of God. And he just healed you. You know it's him. You know he's the Son of God. And now you're fearful of your dad? I was like, bro, you got to get over this fear thing. Like, you've got to give your life to Jesus. He goes, no. He says, my father's a marble. I cannot do this. He's a disgrace to my family. I cannot do this. And I go, he healed you. And I just from that moment, I was just like, oh my gosh, the biggest miracle is not a sign and a wonder. It is the transformation of a human heart. However you get there, a Bible verse, a bumper sticker, an I love you, a healing, whatever. I just, like that moment, it shifted my perspective about signs and wonders. I was like, the biggest sign is that a human being who hates God would submit themselves to God and would turn their heart over to him and give him the keys to the car. Like, that is the big miracle. That is the big one. Okay, so I'll move on, tell you a few more. So just another, just, you know, this was a miracle of necessity. So one day, my family and a few friends had put together a care package for me consisting mostly of peanut butter crackers. Thank you, Lord, for people who were willing to spend $8 on peanut butter crackers and $50 to send them in the mail. And so, because where I was at, all the snacks they had were sugary snacks. They had no salty snacks. That was an unheard of concept. They did not know what a Dorito was, a chip, a cracker, nothing. That was like, they'd never heard of that. I was like, do you have any salty snacks? They're like, what is that? And I'm like, well, it's like a cookie, but it's not a cookie. It's salty instead of sugary. And they're like, this sounds good. And I'm like, well, I'm getting some from America, friends. We're gonna chow down on some peanut butter crackers. So anyway, so we go to the post office, which is downtown. And the reason I want to tell you this is because, or the reason this matters a little bit, give you a little bit of context. In their culture, it wasn't third world, but it was like maybe just a step above that. So there was a lot of infrastructure not in place. And in their society, in their culture, being the head of the postal office was a like high ranking position in the government. I mean, it wasn't like the highest. It wasn't like, you know, president or whatever, but it was around here, nobody gives respect to the lady on the other side of the desk at the post office. Okay. They're very different story. Like you got to dress up. You, yes, sir. No, sir. You mean you, it's like, you better, you know, mind your P's and Q's and talk to this person because they have control of your parcel. And they may decide not to give it to you. Or they may decide to abscond it. There's a lot of crookedness. And so they're kind of warning me about this as we're on our way up there. And I'm like, I'm just like, we're getting my peanut butter crackers. And they're like, well, you may have to pay a tariff. What that means is you got to bribe them. Okay? And I'm like, I'm not bribing this guy to pick up my crackers. I don't have any money anyway. But if I did, I'm sure as heck not giving it to this guy to get something that's mine. And they're like, okay, well, we'll see. Like, okay. So this is the pastor's son, Sheck. Sheck takes me to the post office, him and Hum Hum. And we go, and I've got this great picture of me, Sheck, and Hum Hum outside the post office right after this story, okay? And so it was a great moment. Okay, so we walk into the post office, and you got to tell them all this stuff. It's a difficult deal because they don't deliver. It's not like here where they deliver to your house. Like, you would get notice of a piece, like a pink slip or something that would show up that would let you know, or you could call in and let and ask, hey, is my parcel there? Is my parcel there? And you'd have to have an ID or whatever, but they don't deliver it to your place. So we show up and we give them our information and they sit down and this guy, he's all dressed, you know, very officially looking. And I sit down and, So Sheck, you know, introduces the idea, hey, this is, you know, our friend Brad, and he wants to pick up his parcel. And the guy sees that I'm white, and he just kind of smirks. And Sheck looks over at me and he goes, I don't think this is going to be good. And I go, oh, we're going to get through this, friend. And he says, so then I look at the official, and the official sticks his feet up on the desk, crosses his feet, and looks at me and says, and just looks at me like, so what are you going to offer me? And he says something, and I don't know if it was like, what, or what's my offer? I don't know what he said. He said something to Sheck, and Sheck was like, he wants to know what you're going to give him. I said, you tell him I'm not going to give him anything. I want my package. And he says, I don't know that that is a good idea. And I said, tell him I came here to pick up my package, and I'm not paying him anything, and I want my package. And he goes, okay. And so he says, you know, whatever he says, and the guy goes, and then, you know, says something, and checks like, he's not going to give you the package if you don't give him money. And I just like, oh, yes, yes. And I just, it's just boldness just hits me, and I stand up, and this guy doesn't know English. It's real clear. I stand up, and I put him out. I say, in the name of Jesus, you're going to give me my package, and I'm not giving you one penny. And as soon as I did, I'd seen this once before. His countenance shifted completely, and he just started writing down some paper, gave us the package, and we walked out. And Sheck looked at me, he goes, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. He was like, and Hum and him are like, they're like, oh, they're like this. They're going, oh, my gosh. And I go, I'm not paying for my crackers. They already paid a ripoff price in America to get these crackers. And then you better believe they had to pay blood, sweat, and tears to ship it over here. We're not paying a tariff on the end of that thing. And so they're like, oh my gosh, what happened? And both of them were like retelling the story later to the family, to the pastor. And they're like, you know, when Brad did the thing, like just pointed at him, like something happened to the man. He didn't hear him. He just got struck with like God or something. And like, he didn't say anything. He just finished the paperwork and gave us the good. And we just walked out. It was like, oh my gosh. So when we walk out of the post office, we take this picture, and it's the three of us like, like the Lord just gave us the peanut butter crackers. So I gave him some right there. And Hum, that dirty, he fell in love with those peanut butter crackers. He ate more of them than me. I'd come home because we wound up getting our own apartment together outside of Cardair's. I brought Hum with me, and I'm like, bro, I'm getting you out of here. And so we got our own apartment. The church helped us figure out how we could do that. And so anyways, he's living with me, and I've got this stack of peanut butter crackers, and I notice every day the stack is getting less and less. One day I found three wrappers right there, and I found Hum over in the corner finishing up the last one. Before he could see me, I go, Hum, are you eating these crackers? He's like, this good, my guys. This good, this delicious. He says, these peanut butter crackers is delicious. And I go, stop eating my crackers. It cost us $70 or $60 to get it over here. And so he's eating my crackers. And so anyway, so just cool story there. Okay, I'll give you another one. Just I'm trying to touch on a few different areas of ways that the Lord was showing up. These aren't all the stories. I don't have time for all of them, but just to give you a few. So so I'm now attending this church, okay? You just got to get a picture for this, all right? It is a Pentecostal church. I mean, like, old school Pentecostal African style, which you just cannot imagine how wild that is, all right? And the educated class, which a bunch of this church were above the of the educated class, spoke French. So the way that it works over in Africa, for the most part, most nations are defined as either Anglophone or Francophone. And what that just means is they either teach the educated population, those that are able to actually go to school and learn kind of like the business language, they either teach them English if it's an Anglophone country or French if it's Francophone. So this was a Francophone country, so there were several that knew French. But most of the preaching was in the native tongue because everybody knew Bambara because they were all, you know, of that ethnic group. And so they all knew Bambara. So now just imagine worship, okay? There's French, which I don't know. There's Bambara, which I for sure don't know. And it's Pentecostal, so there's every tongue under the sun. And they are really Pentecostal, so it's way more tongues than whatever you've experienced. I had no clue what was going on every Sunday. I'm there, and I'm like, I would feel the presence of the Lord in worship, but I don't know what they're singing. I just sing my own song. I mean, we're worshiping, and they're all going for it, and the tambourines, and people up there, and they're singing, they're going for it, singing, going. And I'm like, Jesus, I love you. This is beautiful. One of these days, you're going to have to tell me what in the world these people are singing about, because there are no slides and no projector. This is, we're in Africa. We got that. And so I was just glad to be in a place that loved Jesus, okay, and be able to use that as a hub to go out and do ministry. It humbled me so much. These people, they were so poor. They took up two offerings every week. One offering they took up for the church, for the tithes, and then they took up a special offering every week for their missionary, Brad from America. They take up this offering. I mean, the total offering would be something like, in American dollars, maybe like $2. But they were given. They were giving all they could to support this missionary. I tried to get them to stop, and they wouldn't stop. They're like, we prayed for a missionary from America. And I'll be darned if you're going to take the right from us and this joy of being able to sow into you. They were just so kind to me. They fed me. They took care of me. They were amazing. So one day in worship, there was, again, chaotic Pentecostal worship, okay? In the middle of it, the pastor's wife starts going off in her tongue. And I could tell because it didn't sound like Bambara. Bambara has a distinct kind of a sound, and it wasn't French for sure. It was definitely her tongue. And she was going off, and it was one of those moments where you could tell the Holy Spirit was kind of doing something because she started to get kind of like a supernatural moment occurred where she's now kind of like proclaiming loudly in this tongue, and the rest of the congregation is dialing down. So it's like all of them kind of knew this was a tongue that was about to be interpreted, you know? And I was like, this is so cool. I've never seen this. This is going to be awesome. I'm like, Lord, oh, this is so cool. We're about to see interpretation of tongues. Like, I could feel it. I was like, who are you going to give the interpretation to? And I heard the Holy Spirit say, you. I go, Lord, that's funny. No, really? And she starts talking, and all of a sudden, I start hearing in English what she's saying. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. I know. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. I know what she's saying. And I'm like, I have to catch myself and go, would you get over it for a minute and, like, give the word? And I'm like, oh, my gosh. I go, Pastor, I know this sounds so crazy. I have the interpretation. He goes, okay. I mean, it was really easy for him. He's like, okay. And the congregation was just like intently listening. And I'm like, okay, now let me tell you how this had to go. All right. She's giving a tongue. I only know English. So I have to say what she said in English so that someone can translate it into Bambara so the people can hear it. It was so wild, and it turned out to be like this crazy, like the whole church was like, oh my goodness. I mean, it was like the right on word, you know, like the moment where it was just like, that was just what they'd been thinking. I don't even remember the word. I was so freaked out by the experience. I don't even remember the word. I sure wish I'd written it down. Maybe I've got it in an old journal. I'll look. But anyway, my point is the Lord used the absolute least likely but most willing vessel in the room to interpret a tongue to the congregation that I don't know this congregation real well. I mean, I've only been there 3 times or something at that point, maybe 4 or something. I don't know, just a few times. I'm just getting to know them. They're just getting to know me. And the Lord gave the pastor's wife a tongue that was an exhortation for the church that was right on for the church. But in order for her to know what it was, there needed to be an interpreter who just happened to be the guy from America that didn't know anything about anything. And so they were so encouraged. It was like this Holy Spirit moment because they were like, the Lord set this up to encourage this church. Because if the pastor's wife would have just gotten up and said, church, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, they would have been edified, but not like this. This went to a whole new level. Because at this point now, they're seeing, oh my gosh, the Lord really is speaking. That's not the pastor's wife speaking. That's the Holy Spirit speaking. And he set it up and like did all this exclamation mark kind of a thing to speak the word to him. All right? I'll tell you one or two more. So my time's coming to an end. I know you guys know this part of the story, but it's just so powerful. I want to share it because I think it helps connect back to where we're at. So I'm there for some months. When I left, I sold everything. I thought I was going over there for a decade or for life. I certainly didn't think I was going over there for 3 months. I certainly didn't think that. And so it's maybe 2.5 months in, something like that, and I start to feel it's an impression and it's light that my time is done and I'm supposed to come home. And I am rebuking that like it's the devil every day. Devil, you stop trying to take me out of my calling. I'm not giving up this anointing. Pride. And so anyway, I was like, but Lord, I want what you want. If this is really you, would you please speak a little louder? Like, I'd hate to get back home and realize I made a grave mistake because I had a hunch one day that I was supposed to come back home. I mean, that's not, you don't end 3 years of praying to go to Africa, all the work to get to Africa, all this work that started in Africa. You don't come home because you have a hunch one day, right? So there's just a little leadership lesson for you. Whatever you do, don't do that. Wait, pray, ask for more. I was asking for more, and I said, Lord, I know you can speak any way you like, but here's what I'd like. If you're willing, would you give somebody in America a dream about me coming home early? I'm not going to tell anybody I'm thinking this. They all think I'm gone. They've all kissed me goodbye. My mom cried at the airport. My son's going to die a martyr in Africa. I mean, so they're all thinking I'm gone. I'm not coming back. It's over. I gave people my stuff. And I'm like, hey, you want this? Like, yeah, you can have this. Here's my CD player. I gave it away, and I went to Africa. So I'm not telling anybody. I said, Lord, if it be so kind, just, I want to do what you want. I care about this. I want to do right. I want to follow Jesus. Speak to me any way you will, but if you're willing, give me this token. Give me this sign. Speak to somebody in America about me coming home early and give them a dream. A dream that's short about me coming home early, and if I've got the timing right, I'm supposed to come home like now-ish, like I'm done. Then let everything in the dream be the color red. And I said, Lord, if I've got the idea right, I'm supposed to come home early, but it's not right now. It's 6 months from now or a year from now. You're just trying to tell me I'm not going to be over here for forever, you know? Then give somebody a dream in America about me coming home early and let everything in the dream be the color blue. Okay? Amen. I journaled it. All right. And the way you guys do fleeces, just so you know, when you read the passage in Judges 6, when Gideon throws out the fleece, he does not give God an ultimatum. Fleeces do not have ultimatums. This is what an ultimatum would look like. God, if you do this fleece, I'll do this. But if you don't do this fleece, I will not do it. That's an ultimatum. Don't ever be there. A fleece is, Lord, please, pretty please, please help me. Look at me. I'm 5. I need help. Help, help, help. Please, please, please. If you do this, I'll know for sure. But no ultimatum on the other end. Like, if you don't do this, then blah, blah, blah. Don't do the then blah, blah, blah. And you'll always be safe with fleeces. Okay. It's a few days later, a week later, and I go to check my email. There was a little internet cafe that had murderously slow internet connection. Modem dial-up, murderously slow internet connection. And the more people that were in there, the slower it was. So I was always like trying to get people to leave, you know, like I'd go in there stinking on purpose, you know. And anyway, so I'm checking my email, and one of my old students from being back at the Baptist youth group, she emails me, and I'll give you the short version. So just if you ever hear me tell the long version, there's more details. Short version is she sends me this email, and it says, Brad, I had this dream. You were coming home early. I know that God never speaks to me in dreams, but it was just a neat dream about you coming home early, and everything in the dream was the color red. Your shirt was red. The walls were red. Your face was red. Everything in the dream was red. Does that mean something? Only that God speaks and listens to people. Like, I had never asked something so specific in my life. I mean, can you imagine? This is a two-way conversation with God. God, would you give someone in America a short dream about everything red? Yes, Brad, I will. Boom. And it comes back to me, and I'm like, dang! You didn't have a dream. That's God talking to me. God. God is real. He's so real. He's so real. He talks. And I guess I'm coming home. Dang. You know, I think the Lord gave me that sign because it was a tough pill to swallow. That was a toughie. And I did. I came home, and I was bored to tears. You know, the Lord said, go into all the world and preach the gospel. And here the Lord is calling me out of all the world back to Arlington to do who knows what. And I come back, and I'm bored to tears. And it's in the process of all that that this church started. It's in the process of that that the prayer room started. It's in the process of that that all this started. There are marriages in this room that happen because you met your spouse in this context. There are babies that are on this planet because of those marriages, all connected back to that. You know, I just think about that. I'm like, wow, wow. Well, I want to tell you one more component here and then we'll quit. When that church started, it was a little house church. And some of you guys know that history. We can tell that at another date. But we started this little house church, and I still was discipling those three guys via email and a little bit of phone calls back from here, from America. And this little house church, small group, whatever, we were sowing into Mustafa, who went back to his home town of Dakar, Senegal. Yeah, Dakar is the capital. And he had planted a Christian church, a church and a Christian school back in Dakar, and the Lord's grace was on him. I mean, if I went to Africa for no other reason than Hum Hum and Mustafa, it's all worth it. Mustafa starts climbing like crazy after Jesus, and the Lord, his grace is on him. He becomes a pastor overnight. What I didn't know about Mustafa was he was actually raised in a Christian home and became a Muslim. And he knew the truths, but he wasn't following Jesus. And he told me later, he said, "It wasn't your preaching that got me to give my life to Jesus. It was that you followed Jesus to come to Africa, to lay down everything and to come to Africa." He said, "I could not believe that." He was a very analytical man, very smart guy. He said, "It was that testimony." He says, "I could not believe that you would do that, because that meant that God was real. That meant that your Jesus was real. Because I know you now, Brad. I know you, and you follow God, and that's why I gave my life to Jesus." And so he already had a foundation from back in the day that I didn't know about. He didn't tell me. So I'm spending every day preaching to him. He already knows it. He's just, what he's catching in those preachings is he's catching the zeal of God that's on this 22-year-old that laid it all down to go to Africa for that dude, and he knew it. And he knew, he told me, he said, "I know God sent you here for me." He said, "I know it." And so he called me a spiritual father in his life. And so he started to plant this church and this Christian school. A couple points, and then I'll quit. Point one, this school was a Christian school in an all-Muslim nation where public education didn't exist. The only education that existed was private schools. And because the predominance of the culture was Muslim, all the schools were Muslim schools, except this one that was his. Our house church, Forerunner Fellowship's early beginnings, bought him a computer. And it was the only computer at any of the schools in any of the areas nearby. And Muslim parents were sending their Muslim kids to this Christian school to get an education because they get trained on the computer. And then he's getting to win the kids and then some of the family members into the church. So the church is growing. They do this evangelistic outreach. We sow some money. We sowed about $1,300 into this. They do this evangelistic outreach. They go for 2 months out into the bush with a team of people. They go to 20 different Muslim villages. I'm talking like mud hut villages. They go to 20 different Muslim villages and they preach the gospel. They'd stay there for a few days, a week, and then they go to the next one, they go to the next one. They saw nearly 100% of 20 villages convert to Jesus. 640 people came to Jesus in the course of 2 months in 20 different Muslim villages all across the outskirts of Dakar. His plan part of the culture of Islam is there are a bajillion orphans. It's just part of what their culture breeds, is lots and lots of orphans, because there's just so much immorality that's unchecked, especially in the liberal Muslim countries. So you've got orphans everywhere. I don't know how many tens of thousands of orphans I saw while I was over there. It was unreal. They're all wandering around the streets. It was crazy. And then they'd all just kind of sleep somewhere at night. It was just wild. His plan was to take two of the orphans, some of the older ones at each of the villages, and bring them back to the city with them to give them a real education, which they would have never had, to disciple them in Jesus, to train them to be pastors, to then send them back to their villages to be pastors over their villages. Guys, there is no way this story is possible. This is totally impossible and God did it. And all he needed was somebody to just say yes. And it wasn't me making up a, you know, don't walk out of here going, I'm going to Africa. Don't go to Africa. Go to wherever God tells you to go. Go start a small group if he tells you. Go start a business if he tells you. Go to Africa if he tells you. Go to wherever. Follow the Lord. He's got a plan, and when you walk in his plan, he'll move heavens and earth to make things work, and you just have no idea. I thought me going over there was about me getting to preach to masses. It was probably about going to be a witness to Mustafa, so Mustafa could raise up, who knows what that looks like now? We lost contact about 7 years ago. Who knows what that looks like now? Who knows how many churches have been put? Who knows the inheritance that we have? That we have because of that. Just follow Jesus.
This concludes this teaching from Forerunner Fellowship. For more information about our congregation, visit forerunnerfellowship.org. Thank you.